Hello and welcome to the World Nuclear News Podcast. I'm Alex Hunt. This month's episode is a special report on the industry's annual gathering at World Nuclear Symposium, held in London. Claire Maiden and Warwick Pipe have detailed segments on the outlook for global nuclear fuel cycle, financing nuclear, and also hear about the launch of the industry's new net zero nuclear campaign. Plus, there's discussion about the best way to attract the huge numbers of new staff the nuclear sector will need as it plans to triple in size, including the view of nuclear science student and nuclear advocate Grace Stanky, also the current Miss America.
All of my peers were going into mechanical engineering or aerospace because they wanted to work at these cool, swaggy companies. Nuclear is just as cool and just as awesome and just as exciting. So it's really become my mission to make it exciting, to make nuclear cool again, to change that public perception of what nuclear science is and how we can continue to improve that.
We'll have more on that later, but first, this year's event in London was the most heavily subscribed for years, reflecting both the moving on from COVID and also the continued growth and interest in nuclear energy and its future prospects. World Nuclear Association Director General Samuel Bilbao-Leon's message was a clear one.
We have a great window of opportunity. So we have the recognition of the policymakers, we have the attention of the finance community. Now we really need to get our act together and deliver to make the most of the huge opportunity that we have.
The Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Mariano Grossi, taking part in a panel on nuclear's role in creating global growth and prosperity, also stressed the benefits of working together.
In the past, industry, regulation, IEA, although vaguely working in a sort of a coordinated way, were actually not. So there was not dialogue, not much of a conversation, perhaps some personal friendships, but we didn't have a concerted decision to work together and see, while, of course, respecting our own roles, and in particular me, because I'm the head of an international organization, and I, of course, respond and I'm accountable to my member states, looking at those points, those bottlenecks, those facilitating moments where the global institutions can do certain things so that these national efforts, as the minister was just describing, or from the industry point of view, are coming together. And so looking at the problems that do exist is, of course, some say, having half of the solution.
But events in Ukraine remain at the forefront of his thoughts.
That we should be reminded of things that we have to be working on tirelessly. The first, if I may say, is that we have to make sure that there is no nuclear accident in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget for a single moment that we have the largest nuclear power plant in Europe in a combat zone, all right? So I guess that it is clear for us that if, God forbid, there was an attack on this nuclear power plant or something going wrong inside it, many of these visions, plans, ideas, aspirations, I wouldn't say that they are not going to happen, but believe me, it will be much more difficult to bring our communities, our societies, the constituencies that the politicians convince to do stuff, that this is something that has to happen. And I want to say it because I have now, today, a group of dedicated, courageous IEA members there at occupied territory, listening to the thunder of heavy artillery every day.
The IAEA Director General also discussed the challenges of changing business models and adapting regulatory processes if the international ambitions of small modular reactors are going to be achieved.
We are not there yet. We have started an effort, we are moving forward, but we still see that there is this important barrier perhaps in front of us that makes it sometimes a bit difficult to think about nuclear or to stop thinking about nuclear with the eyes of the 1980s or the 1970s. So if we are in 2023, if we are thinking about the decarbonization goals that we have set to ourselves.
And the first day also saw the official launch of the Net Zero Nuclear Campaign, as World Nuclear Association Samo Bilbao-Leon explained.
So we have planned many activities from now until then to actually raise the visibility of nuclear energy at a global level. So when we get to COP, everybody will be fully aware of what's going on, what's important to use nuclear, but also beyond. It's not just COP, it's the as we were saying in the previous session, we have 25 years in front of us to achieve net zero by 2050.
The campaign, which seeks to increase nuclear energy capacity threefold by 2050, was launched with Emirates Nuclear Energy Corporation, whose managing director and CEO Mohamed Al-Hamadi said that after the COP climate change summits in Scotland and Egypt, at this year's event in the United Arab Emirates,
we have a golden opportunity. There's a great buy-in, a great interest from all sectors to be part of this solution of net zero. And for us to set a target of tripling nuclear from now until 2050, I think it's an achievable target. And the message or the responsibility onerous in each one of us in this room is to see how we can make that happen as industry.
World Nuclear Association's annual symposium has long been the place to be in September for anyone with an interest in nuclear fuel supply and demand. This year's symposium saw the launch of the 21st edition of the Association's Nuclear Fuel Report. Now, the Association and its forerunner organisation, the Uranium Institute, has been publishing this report regularly since the mid-1970s, so it has a very long pedigree. And the new edition of the report takes a long, hard look at what's going to be needed for fueling our nuclear future. Here's Kajal Desai, World Nuclear Association's Senior Programme Lead for Fuel Cycle, to tell us a little more about it.
So the Nuclear Fuel Report Global Scenarios for Demand and Supply Availability 2023 to 2040 considers three scenarios: the reference scenario, the upper scenario, and the lower scenario. The reference scenario, importantly, is informed by government and utility targets and objectives. The lower scenario assumes delays in implementing these plans, while the upper scenario is underpinned by more favourable conditions, largely reflecting the targets announced in many countries to achieve net zero carbon emissions and the acceptance that nuclear power will play an indispensable role in reaching this goal.
Two major drivers identified in this year's report are climate change and also the geopolitical instability that's emerged since the previous edition. So the latest report sits within a whole new context. And as well as leading to increased interest in nuclear power for energy security and sovereignty, this has had significant implications for the globalised market for nuclear fuel cycle services, with utilities, suppliers and governments looking for opportunities to diversify supplies. ConverDyn's CEO Malcolm Critchley, a co-chair of the working group that drafted the report, summarised the report like this.
So the key themes that you've been hearing here is that demand growth is projected in all of the scenarios. A lot of the demand is driven by Asia. SMRs play a role, and also lifetime extensions. We're seeing positive market conditions after a long period of decline. Primary supply is only sufficient to cover about three quarters of demand, so by inference, new supply is going to be required going forward. China will maintain a policy of self-sufficiency in conversion, enrichment and fabrication. There are near-term shortages in conversion. The Western enrichers are already taking steps to increase their capacity. Fuel fabrication, perhaps a lot of different things happening there, with as Tariq mentioned. And then the final point is the era of the reliance on secondary supply has ended.
So the world looks very different today to when the last report came out in 2021. Here's Chris Frankland, Director of Sales and Marketing, Nuclear Fuels Corporation, who chaired the report's uranium subgroup.
So when comparing the 2021 environment outcomes report to where we are today, I think Malcolm hit on a large portion of the themes. We are in a different world today for several reasons. And one of those is really looking on the supply side and the uranium production side. One in 2021 that was definitely more reflective of lower investment, poor market conditions, assets that had to be put up for economic reasons, and really the indicators that distilled out of the 2023 report showed us that we have turned that corner. The investment is coming back into the sector. We're seeing assets turn back on, as Malcolm listed, and really reflective of better conditions and a better future. So those are kind of some of the themes. An additional takeaway that I want to leave the audience with is, again, WNA affirming that there are adequate global uranium resources to meet all requirement scenarios, right? But it is really going to come down to the execution and delivery of the production projects that we've listed, categorized in all of the buckets that we have, the existing, the idled, the potential, the possible, and those are all detailed in the report, but we're going to need everybody to be able to deliver, to be able to meet these growth scenarios that are presented in the 2023 report.
So are we going to be able to meet this challenge? Well, that's a question Kajal put to Malcolm Critchley.
So Malcolm, I think looking to the future and some of the supply-demand charts that we saw in your presentation, given the heavy reliance on unspecified supply in the future, does the supply side now have sufficient time to respond?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, as Chris mentioned, there's enough resources there, at least as predicted by the Red Book, and the prices that we're seeing in the market look like the prices that would be needed to bring those deposits online. But I don't think just sort of one data point is going to be enough to encourage people to move forward quickly. What's needed? Well, first of all, I think there needs to be a recognition that there is a problem and that some of these projects need to be accelerated, and there needs to be incentives for that to happen. And I think we're at a point now where we are running out of time, and there needs to be more collaboration between buyers and suppliers. I don't think we can just sit back and hope that sort of organic demand will ultimately result in supply. It's going to need a much more proactive approach.
And in the words of Gene Tortorelli, Director of Nuclear Fuel Supply at Constellation Energy Generation, this is a wake-up call.
I think some of these, when we look at these global reports, it's easy to say, okay, I need this. But this report, I think, is starting to highlight that turn from there was quite a bit, and I think every demand line in this report is higher than the prior report. So that's kind of a wake-up call where things are tightening up, and you need to sort of pay more attention and be more careful about where the supply is. You can't assume it can just book transfer it somewhere, because it may not work. But that said, and Chris touched on it, there are ample uranium reserves. And so the material's out there. Do we have time to start with, whether we need to add conversion and enrichment? It sort of leads me to the next question, which is what does the industry needs to do? And I would say first and foremost, and maybe just as an operator, is the operators have to continue to operate safe and error-free.
So if you're interested in knowing more about the fuel report, there is information on World Nuclear Association's website and in the show notes.
So the message was clearly that there is expansion on the way for nuclear energy capacity around the world. But one of the big challenges is the necessary vast expansion of the workforce to make it happen. At a session considering the key role that people play at all levels, Tamar Al-Bashawi, Chief Nuclear Officer for EDF's Hinkley Point C project in the UK, recounted how times have changed in terms of recruitment.
That's what I was told when I started. You join the nuclear industry because it's a job for life. I remember that. That was in my assessment centre for the job. I think now if you say that to people, you will scare some people.
Callum Thomas, chairman of Thomas Thor Nuclear Recruitment Specialists, added,
the awareness campaign that I was involved in, the creative agency came back with this idea of job for life. And the feedback was, it sounds a bit like a prison sentence. and if you're starting your career now and you're going to probably live till you're over 100, I think you're right. I think people are maybe a little bit scared by that now. So it's perhaps, needs updating the message.
Grace Stanky, who is in her last class for her nuclear engineering degree, which she fits in alongside her global advocacy for nuclear as Miss America, agreed that the job for life was not a selling point for her and her contemporaries.
I feel like that's what a lot of my peers and people who are going through this recruitment process are afraid of, is becoming just another cog in the system. And like, you want to be heard and listened to and not just like, okay, nuclear, job for life.
She also explained how she got into nuclear in the first place.
One story I like to tell is really how I got into nuclear and why I stayed in nuclear. And how I got into it is honestly out of spite. I asked my dad, I'm thinking aerospace or nuclear engineering. What do you think? I'm a 16-year-old teenage girl. And he looks at me and he goes, Grace, don't go into nuclear. There's no future there. So as I got into my degree, that freshman year of college was truly pivotal. And I think I went through the learning experience that we as nuclear industry people want every single human being to go through. That freshman year of college, I learned, one, that nuclear medicine is something that I didn't even know about. It actually saved my dad's life twice from cancer. He's alive, happy, healthy, retired, doing great today. I also learned that nuclear energy powers 20% of America. That's a lot more than two power plants than what I initially thought. And third, I worked in a nuclear fusion lab that freshman year, and fusion showed me what nuclear power can be. And that sold me on it from there. I said, okay, nuclear science is all around me, and now why aren't we using it to its fullest capability? Why didn't I know about this? All of my peers were going into mechanical engineering or aerospace because they wanted to work at these cool, swaggy companies. Nuclear is just as cool and just as awesome and just as exciting. So it's really become my mission to make it exciting, to make nuclear cool again, to change that public perception of what nuclear science is and how we can continue to improve that.
The session heard that in the UK, the estimate is that there will need to be a tripling of the nuclear sector workforce over the next decade. And it's a similar picture in other countries. Thomas noted that he had seen a trend towards competence-based hiring.
So whereas before, most job descriptions we would see would say we want 20 years project management experience in a nuclear facility with this, this, and this. But ultimately, that pool of people is so small. And now, for leadership roles, we're seeing the priority competences are around, we want people that have led transformation. We want people that have a track record of having built inclusive teams with low turnover. We want people that have worked in environments with international stakeholders or complex stakeholder groups. And a lot of these competencies are not nuclear specific. And of course, then you'll have, you may need nuclear experience for some roles, but for others, it may be fine for it to be experience from a regulated industry. So this kind of competence-led approach opens up the a wider pool of people, and I think that's a big part of recruitment strategies now as well.
He also announced the launch of a new global mentoring program with Women in Nuclear Global, which is going to launch later this year.
All you need to do is open to everyone in the sector. It's not just for women. It's open to everyone in the sector at all levels, all genders, all characteristics. It's very straightforward. You need to become a member of WIN Global. It's free. And this is really the first call to the industry to attract mentors and mentees to the program.
There was a panel on achieving end users' decarbonisation goals with nuclear energy. The moderator of the session, Charlotte Griffiths, who's Deputy Director of the Sustainable Energy Division and Chief of Section at the United Nations Economic Commission for Europe, had this to say about nuclear's role.
Achieving net zero will mean decarbonising the hard-to-abate sectors in industry. Nuclear energy really has a role to play. It's well-placed as a low-carbon energy source. It delivers uninterrupted electricity and heat 24/7. We heard that this morning. But closing the implementation gap to getting to net zero can be driven not just by government policy, but by end users and their decarbonisation goals.
She went on to say that decarbonising the electricity sector alone is not enough for the world to meet its net zero ambitions.
The hard-to-abate sectors in industry, such as steel, cement, transportation, and chemicals, those account for over 40% of global CO2 emissions. They also need to be addressed. And those industries require reliable, affordable energy sources that can provide the heat and electricity. But meeting the demands of low-carbon energy is going to be a challenge. And nuclear energy is one of the few options that can do so effectively.
Mohammed Al-Hamadi, Managing Director and CEO of the Emirates Nuclear Energy Corporation, noted that cloud computing and data centres have created a huge demand for electricity.
Cloud computing, by the way, today consumes 5% of the energy consumption. It generates around 2% of the world emissions. 2%, by the way, of the world emission from this 5% is more than all civil aviation in the world, just to put things in perspective. So huge demand.
Todd Noy, Director of Nuclear Technologies Strategy at Microsoft, discussed his company's energy requirements for his data centers and how it sees the use of nuclear energy.
Our energy needs are multi gigawatts, as it is right now. And the growth is near exponential that we're anticipating. Not just us, other large data center operators. So obviously, we need energy. So Microsoft has an energy agnostic approach to carbon-free energy. Within the last year, we've added nuclear to our electric policy statement of what we're willing to support to be carbon free. We have, as you mentioned, entered agreements where we purchase, like OPG, we purchase nuclear energy credits that we use as clean energy credits. We have carbon matching agreement with Constellation Energy. But our big need is we need electrons in the future. And we have what we call a 100-100-0 goal, and that is 100% of the electrons we consume, 100% of the time, has zero carbon affiliated with them.
Core Power Chairman and CEO Mikkel Boe described the shipping industry as the backbone of global trade, but noted it consumes about 350 million tons of fossil fuels annually and accounts for about 3% of total worldwide carbon emissions. The industry has been mandated by the United Nations to reach net zero by 2050.
Moving the transport of global trade away from fossil fuel presents an almost unsurmountable challenge of scale, which is what we're talking about here today. And the alternative fuels that are being proposed as an interim step towards that zero goal is things like ammonia and methanol and other things that contain a little bit less carbon, and some with no carbon. But they're all produced from natural gas today. And if we continue to do that and fool ourselves into thinking that that's actually going to work, we're going to increase the emissions from the global transportation sector by a factor of 5, which means we go from about 3% to about 15%. And that isn't a solution. So nuclear is really the only true zero emission energy for the lifetime of ships. No other energy source or power system can give us that true zero emission.
Enex Al-Hamadi said the nuclear industry should use the COP28 climate conference, which is taking place in the UAE later this year, to highlight nuclear's role in combating climate change, beyond just electricity generation. Here's what he had to say.
I think we have a great opportunity and a golden opportunity, a unique opportunity for us to showcase all those success stories and showcase even the demand that's required for the future, and coupling that with solutions that we can provide, be it advanced reactors, SMRs, or conventional reactors. We have huge solutions that we can explain to the world and people, and get people in the world to buy into the solutions.
So a very clear message that came out of the symposium this year is that nuclear is going to be vital for reaching net zero, and that's going to need a big expansion of nuclear capacity. But what about the nuclear plants that we already have? Well, it's also vitally important to get the most out of the plants that are already in operation or are being built now. And a session on optimising plant life performance, which was presented in collaboration with the World Association of Nuclear Operators, WANO, was devoted to just that, giving a platform for plant operators from around the world to share experiences and their thoughts on this vital issue. As Wano's CEO, Dr. Naoki Chigusa, said, optimising plant performance matters for everyone in the nuclear sector, from power companies to financial institutions to suppliers to other organisations. And Wano, which was set up in 1989 and whose 125 members include the operators of all the world's existing nuclear power plants, as well as some 60 that are under construction, begins supporting its members to do this even before the first concrete is poured for a new reactor.
Our philosophy is to unite the competitive industries into the communities of nuclear operators that is cohesive, highly collaborative, and fully committed to this safe and reliable operation. These are some our philosophy, and also the very important founding principle. So please understand that unite competitive industry into cohesive, highly collaborative, and fully committed. This is a very unique approach for us to create such a very important optimizing society towards the operators also.
So the speakers in this session brought many years of cumulative experience in the operation of nuclear power plants around the world and shared the benefits of that experience. And a panellist who can definitely speak from a position of long experience is Vinod Kumar, the Station Director of Nuclear Power Corporation of India Limited's Kaiga 3 and 4, who is also certified to lead Wano peer reviews. He spoke of the very real impact of Wano missions when it comes to improving plant operations.
I must say, Wano has been helpful to us in many fronts, and we have been consistently improving our performance because of Wano support missions, Wano peer reviews, and the pre-startup peer reviews. You can see the trend, actually. The performance indicators, which was in the bottom quartile of the Wano performance, has reached to top quartile in the recent performance.
A key ingredient for optimized plant performance, according to Framatome Senior Executive Vice President Catherine Cornell, is innovation. And here she highlighted the very exciting possibilities from digital transformation and better outage performance. But perhaps the most important ingredient is competencies, including retaining experience and best practice.
Competencies are at the heart of our current nuclear industry challenge. Because the skills and expertise are driving the performance of our company, we have developed ambitious programs to attract the best talent, to develop the best talent, but as well to retain our current workforce. So the work environment is essential to attract people. This is why we pay a lot of attention to provide exciting technical environment to our team, develop collaborative approaches based on trust, individual empowerment, and autonomy.
And Chris Cunningham, Vice President of Nuclear Projects at Ontario Power Generation, highlighted the importance of the learning experience in the refurbishment of CANDU units in Ontario, and not just lessons learned from the refurbishment of OPG's own plants, but also from the work that Bruce Power is doing at its plants.
We thought we were really well prepared. You know, we invested in the supply chain, we built facilities so we could do training and train before we actually got into the execution. But when you get into the execution, there's always something that you find and discover. And, you know, what we found is it was a lot harder than we thought. Now, this is a great industry, you know, because we do share, and we work very closely with Bruce to share our lessons learned. We've taken those lessons from the first unit and actively applied them, and we continue to do so. I think we've captured over 6,000 lessons now, and we always keep refining. I get a lessons learned report every week from the new things that we find. And then we implement them, we look to fine-tune and continually improve. And you know, I'm really pleased to say that in our second unit, Unit 3, just came back online very recently, actually 169 days ahead of the committed date. And that's really fantastic news. So that means we're generating electricity ahead of time. And we're really pleased about that.
So there's some great examples there of steps being taken to optimise operations through all the phases of a plant's life. But are nuclear power plants resilient enough to cope with things like extreme weather conditions or an energy crisis? Or is it more important to ensure that we're optimising day-to-day operations rather than focusing on what might be needed to keep them running during extreme events?
Yeah, well, it's. I think if you compare ourselves to other power generators, we're probably the most resilient. Yeah? So it doesn't mean to say that we can't be more resilient. Yeah, but I think we'd have to ask ourselves, do we need to be more resilient? Probably in some areas, probably for some plants, but not all the time. I think you've got to take a, you know, a view across it, because let's not forget, I think we are the most resilient energy generator.
Which kind of also shows that high safety is not necessarily against high capacity factors. So we see that this can go together, and we... Yeah, as you said, I also believe we're a great industry and we should be more proud of it.
At the end there, you heard from Wolfgang Denk, the Managing Director of Swiss Nuclear, the Association of the Swiss Nuclear Power Station Operators, who was the session moderator.
We had an interesting session on investing in nuclear. It started with Keisuke Sadamori of the International Energy Agency giving an overview of investments in clean energy. With regards to nuclear investments, he said,
while the increasing year-on-year at the rate of nearly 15% from about 37 billion to in 2019 before COVID to 65 billion in 2023, nuclear investments remains a small part of overall clean energy investments are around 4% share.
However, you mentioned the IEA report released last year on nuclear power and the secure energy transition, which showed that nuclear power should play a significant role in a secure global pathway to net zero.
So nuclear power need to double from around 400 gigawatts now to more than 800 gigawatts in 2050 in the net zero scenario. The annual clean capacity additions need to reach 27 gigawatts per year in the 2030s, and that's higher than any decade before. And even so, the global share of nuclear in total generations in the net zero world will fall slightly to 8%. Emerging and developing economies account for more than 90% of the global growth, with China set to become the leading nuclear power producer before 2030.
Sadamori went on to say,
the resurgence of nuclear power in the net zero scenario entails a massive increase in investments in the coming decades. The global investments in nuclear surges to over $100 billion in the first half of 2030s in the net zero scenario, and that's over three times the average of the 2010s.
He said there are private sector investors willing to finance nuclear projects, but innovative financing mechanisms are needed to secure this funding. One such mechanism is the Regulated Asset Base, or RAB, which the UK government plans to use for the Sizewell C project. Here's what Ian Smedley of Barclays had to say about RAB.
The RAB model is designed to set up a structure that provides a high level of certainty and confidence and predictability for investors, whilst also making sure that there are appropriate incentives in place. And we'll come back to the incentives part in a moment. So the fundamental concept of the RAB, that's the capital value, the value of the investment in the project, in the company. And that is kind of quasi-accounting metric. It evolves over time, builds up as construction occurs, and then will fall away with depreciation over the life of the asset.
One key issue that deters investors from putting money into nuclear projects is cost and schedule overruns, the panel noted. Here's what Bruce Power's CFO, Kevin Kelly, had to say.
The key here is being able to showcase to the world that we can deliver large-scale projects on time and on budget. And you know, whether it's a multiple billion-dollar refurbishment or new build, you got to stick to the basic principles of having your engineering done, getting your long lead parts, having an established supply chain.
The IEA's Sadamori added,
The industry's role is to ensure that the projects are delivered on time and on budget. And there are ways to, proven ways to decrease the cost overruns and the work the programs in budget. The one way is to produce the same reactors, the same models.
Kevin Kelly mentioned refurbishment projects that have been successfully completed on time and on budget at the Bruce Power Plant in Ontario. Julian Boccabosa, a partner in the Japan office of White and Case, said examples such as this can help the industry give investors confidence to invest in nuclear projects.
Having very successful stories about being on time and on budget will really, really help. And that's why I agreed it was fantastic to hear those stories, because it gives confidence. Lessons learned, I think, is absolutely key in the construction space, of course, but also like for governments, to make sure that if you're putting together a new program, you understand what worked, what didn't work, and you actually implement gateways to ensure that you make it work.
To round off the conference, there was a session on how nuclear can deliver on its potential. Here's Sophie McFarlane-Smith from UK-based Rolls-Royce SMR.
I think one of the things that we really need to do as an industry is actually do what we say we're going to do, actually deliver on our promises, not overpromise, and actually at every step of the way, rebuild the confidence in the industry, rebuild the trust, not just with the government, but with also other stakeholders and members of the public, that actually nuclear can be trusted to deliver, and nuclear can actually have a real contribution to the fight against climate change and for energy security, but they won't start to allow us to do it at scale until they begin to trust the industry again.
Thomas Branch from ASYSTEM said times were changing.
If you had asked me the same question 5 years ago, I would have said what we need is a clear vision, from the governments and so on. I mean, a clear roadmap. Now we have it, so it's over. So I would like to emphasize what Tim just said, and maybe from my experience and from the experience of the company, we are contributing to projects that are difficult, to some that are very successful. And the message would be, as you said, let's be very industrial, and so let's be construction-oriented. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's talk a bit less about the design, which matters, of course. I mean, we are all engineers and we know how it matters, but let's make sure that for real it happens, and it is where we need collaboration.
Romina Velshi, President and CEO of the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, said that collaboration at the international level was key.
Collaboration is kind of in our DNA, so there may be competitors. Now I'm the regulator, so I don't get on the competitive side of the business, but collaboration, sharing information, sharing mistakes, lessons learned, is such an inherent part of this sector that has been built into, as I said, in our very DNA. But I think the stage we're at now, we just need to move a number of levels beyond where we have been. And I'll use Canada as an example. We heard this morning around some successful projects we've had around refurbishment, and they talked about collaboration between the operators, the supply chain. But what we have found as we look at new technologies, that we really need to go outside our borders. And we started off with the United States. Their neighbors are our biggest trading partners, kind of like-minded. It was really the regulators that said, you know, we want to collaborate. We want to jointly do assessment reviews because it's so much more efficient and using our resources more efficiently. And us started that, and then the industry associations joined in, the utilities have joined in, and so now with our technology developer for the SMR, GE Hitachi's BWRX-300, we all sit around the table together on how we're going to deploy this collectively. And so it's just a much more efficient way. But the driver for all of this is an agreement to a standard design, because that's the only way these technologies will be economical. And so the vision of a global fleet of standard designs requires collaboration at the international stage. And we heard from the financing community, we want early engagement. We hear that with the public as well. You know, we want to be there from day minus 100, you know, not on day one. So I think that That's where the collaboration comes. Given the time scale we want to work at, given the buy-in that we need from so many folks, and that we need those early successes, Canada happens to be the first of the G7 countries, at least, to have a grid-scale SMR being built. And if we don't succeed, and by the way, success is more than just on time and on schedule, I must say, you know, as a safety regulator. We heard this morning about the Bruce Unit 6 being connected to the grid. Guess what? It's got the best safety record of all projects, right? So all those things go together. But if that Darlington project is not successful, then it's going to be having a real chilling effect on SMR dreams across the world. So the need for all of us to make sure that these early success stories happen requires that level of collaboration, and it's happening.
Meanwhile, architect Eric Van Agerat's message was that the complexities of nuclear projects should not be overstated.
The scale of which you work is huge. Look at the normal developments. I mean, I can't speak about it because I do a lot of developments worldwide. And an average project takes 5-6 years. So why is suddenly nuclear so dramatically complicated? And yeah, of course, but because you build big things, it's big money involved. It's a lot of interests which are at stake. So take it easy. That's not the problem. It's absolutely, of course, it's nice if you say, I would like to have a nuclear plant tomorrow. Can you give me 2 and you bring me 3? Of course, but it doesn't work this way if I want a new house. It doesn't work the way if I want a new city.
And finally, here's Cameco President and CEO Tim Gitzel.
My message coming out of this is nice that we're all talking, we're getting together, we're making plans, but then we have to go out and execute. And we have to be brave and bold and get off our own wallets and don't expect governments to do things for us. This has to be industry-led. You have to take some risk as a company. It should be government-facilitated, perhaps. We have to work with the regulators. We have to find the people. We've got great technologies, but we have to get out and get into action because our window is open today, but it's not going to stay open forever because there are competing technologies that are going to hand us our lunch if we don't get going. So my message is one of urgency. Let's get going.
So thanks again to Claire Maiden and Warwick Pipe for their reports on the 2023 World Nuclear Symposium and to everyone involved in the event. That's about all that we have time for this edition. You'll be able to find links to more information on the symposium topics covered in the show notes. There's also a link to sign up to our daily and weekly nuclear news roundup emails. And do feel free to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, so you don't miss out on the next edition of the World Nuclear News.